Hello, this is Paul Solentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. You are listening to the Roundhouse Podcast. I thought it would be timely to talk with former Shocker basketball player Terrell Benton about race and the anger and frustration we're seeing from the black community in these times. We talk about growing up black in Derby, his talk with his mother recently, how to talk, how to listen about these issues, and how we can help each other. Thank you for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, and thanks to Terrell Benton for his time. Hello, welcome to the Roundhouse Podcast. This is Paul Solentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. And today we're going to talk about the state of our nation and race relations with Terrell Benton. Terrell played basketball at Wichita State from 1998 to 2002. After attending Derby High School, and when I was preparing for this, I tried to write some sort of introduction, and I would come up with phrases such as, these are difficult times, or this has been a horrible few weeks. And then I would think that a black person might respond that these aren't difficult times, it's not a horrible few weeks, these are just the times, and the weeks have been this way for a long time, and that's the problem, and that's what we're here to discuss with Terrell, kind of what's going on in America, and how do we respond to the problem of racism. Terrell, thanks for your time. I appreciate you giving us a few minutes today.
Yeah, happy to be here, Paul, and truly honored that you thought of me as someone that you might be interested to have this type of dialogue with.
Okay, I guess we can start with, we had the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery kind of late May, came into the spotlight late May. That was followed very closely by George Floyd's death in Minneapolis while a police officer knelt on his neck for 8 minutes. The officer has been charged with second-degree murder, and obviously both those things have come into prominence. So when these things happen, tell me a little bit about what thoughts, what emotions does it stir up in you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Paul. Over the years, there's kind of been a progression, right, or a transition from a series of emotions that initially lent themselves more towards sadness and despair and some of those types of things. But as I think what we're seeing as a nation is that as our community experiences these with pretty frequent, with regularity, that sadness and that despair, even for me personally, has begun to turn into fatigue. It turns into anger. It turns into frustration. It turns into emotions that can sometimes evoke and provocate actions that wouldn't ordinarily. And so I think, you know, when you contemplate these types of traumas over the duration of time that we've experienced them, you're starting to see, again, both from me personally, but also from our community, a shift in the feelings that we're feeling and how we respond to those.
What's it like growing up as a black male in the United States?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a spectrum of experiences that anyone experiences, but certainly as a black male in America, there can be a wide variety of experiences. You know, I grew up in a military home on McConnell Air Force Base where we were to some degree isolated and kept pretty safe. I grew up around an incredibly diverse cast of characters that was constantly rotating in and out because people would get stationed at McConnell and then restationed somewhere else. So for me growing up, at least until probably my more formative years, you know, nearer to high school, I never really contemplated race as an issue that would affect my life. Growing up in, I'm a multiracial, you know, I was raised in an African-American household, but I'm actually half African-American, a quarter Hispanic, and a quarter Czech. And so I come from this kind of melting pot of different backgrounds and experiences, but again, had really no understanding of race relations or the impact that race would have on my life until I got into nearer to my high school years, where I was attending Derby High School, at which point in time was experiencing some pretty difficult race relations at that time. You know, we had the Aryan Nation on our campus handing out propaganda. We had, you know, kids in our lunchroom stand on lunch tables and put on a hood, a KKK hood. So I began to experience those things and recognize that I was different, and that my response to those things was pretty critical as an athlete and as somebody that to some degree stood out amongst others. I realized that my response was pretty critical.
You posted a story on Facebook about a conversation you had with your mother. It's 2 years ago, I think. Tell us about your mom's background. It seems important to this story. And then tell us about the conversation.
Yeah, so my mother, I'm extremely proud of my mother. She started as a cook at Aviano Air Force Base in Italy in the late 70s after enlisting in the Air Force straight out of high school, and worked her way, worked. We ended up at McConnell, and again, was a critical part of my experience growing up is watching my mom's career progress. Ultimately, she retired in the early 2000s as the Command Chief Master Sergeant of the Air National Guard, the highest ranking enlisted personnel in the Air National Guard, and first African American to attain that position, first female to attain that position. 3 or 4 day long retirement ceremony on multiple Air Force bases in DC. She spent, you know, she was in her role during 9/11 and activated and was all over the world for, you know, 300 days a year, you know, visiting troops, keeping morale high, making decisions and things like that affected our position as a country. After that, my mother went on to pursue her master's degree from George Washington University in DC. Obviously, everyone recognizes the prestige that comes with a master's degree from George Washington. She's just a very well-respected woman. And so just a couple of years ago, as tensions began to ratchet up and we began to see more frequent encroachments upon the civil liberties of African American men in particular throughout our community, I'll never forget getting the phone call where my mother, and mind you, you know, I'm a degreed African-American male, pretty well thought of in our community. I serve and do a lot of, I try to do a lot of positive work in our community. And so, but even with all of that being said, that whole construct in place, my mother still felt it necessary to call me and implore me to be as wildly compliant with an officer during any interaction as I possibly can be, you know, hands on steering wheel, make no sudden movements. If possible, make sure that, you know, my driver's license, proof of registration and insurance are out and available before they step to the car. Like, just things that at the time seemed really elementary and really basic. But as I look back on that, I think, man, what was my mother experiencing at that moment in time when she felt it necessary to call her adult son, who's a father, who at the time was married, like what was it that she was experiencing in our country that made her feel obligated to have that conversation with me, and how different is the experience for the non-minorities who don't even have to contemplate those things?
So this is the talk that we hear a lot about. My, you know, it's not something I experienced. My mom, my dad never had the, you know, never felt the need to have that talk with me. Tell me about it. How often does it happen? How does the talk go? And what is the burden, I guess, as a parent of feeling at some point I must sit my children down and have this talk with them about how they interact with police?
Yeah, you know, it's a conversation that's happening more and more frequently throughout our community. Ironically enough, it's a conversation that I had with my daughter last night. I have a mixed race daughter who is outspoken and who is smart and intelligent and is growing up in a school district where she is obviously the minority and is beginning to experience what it's going to be like to not only be a racial minority, but to also be a woman who's going to experience sexism and chauvinism and to have all of that compounded into what is going to be her life experience. I felt like it was necessary to have that conversation with her, not just as it pertains to how she's going to need to interact with you know, authorities, but also just how to interact with people who may not be able to understand her experiences and may not be able to understand her perspective, and how it's important to navigate those relationships with kid gloves and with grace and honor and respect and dignity. And I mean, it's just a conversation that as a minority in America, I feel like it's necessary to have with my minority child.
These conversations about race and law enforcement and protests, how are they different when you talk with your black friends, your black coworkers, and when you talk about it with your white friends, your white coworkers?
Yeah, you know, so obviously as black Americans, we understand it. And I haven't spoken to a single black American, myself included, that advocates for the rioting and the looting and the destruction that has come with these protests. You know, I think there is some things at play that maybe muddy or blur the lines between these protests and some of the more nefarious activities happening subsequent to these protests. But I will say that as black Americans, where, you know, those that I'm speaking to do not advocate, do not agree with the destruction that's kind of parlayed along with these protests. But we understand it, right? We understand how the trauma, you know, with centuries and decades and centuries long trauma can eventually lead to what we're experiencing. This isn't the first time that we've had to riot to see movement in our civil liberties or movement closer towards having equal civil liberties. And so to that extent, and it's frustrating for us because, you know, we've tried in a lot of different capacities to have peaceful protests. And those are oftentimes met with, don't do it that way, right? A general wagging of the nation's finger at us, you know, when Colin Kaepernick takes a knee or when LeBron James speaks out, he's told to shut up and just play basketball, right? So at this point, what are we to do? How would our country like us to respond to the frequent encroachment upon our liberties? Like, help me understand that. And as I ask that of people, I very rarely get a constructive answer, right? Oftentimes the answer is riddled with a series of questions to, in my opinion, help people feel more comfortable. And right now, I don't know that anybody should feel comfortable with anything that's going on in our country. If you're comfortable with the state of affairs in our country, then I'd say there's probably a different set of issues that we need to be having a conversation around. Now, most of my non-minority friends, my white friends, you know, I think there's a general frustration from them in a couple of different ways, right? I'm experiencing frustration from them in that, you know, they are having to suffer the effects of these protests and the riots and the looting. And I understand that because it is uncomfortable and it is unfortunate that the cadence of their normal life is being disrupted by these things. And I don't wish that upon them, but it's an important thing for them to feel because it's a very small snippet of the experience of Black Americans for their entire lifetime. And so they're experiencing that. And I sympathize with them through that. And it's something that I don't want them to have to experience. But the fact that they are, I think, might help them gain perspective on the state of affairs that Black Americans live in. Now, the other thing that is happening amongst my white friends, and this is where I begin to feel saddened for them or frustrated with them and for them, is that they're starting to feel, you know, I've heard several of them say they feel ignorant or they feel frustrated with themselves for not having a better understanding of this. And while no one can take responsibility for their lack of understanding to this point, I don't want any of them to feel ignorant. I don't want any of them to feel despair, if you will, because they don't understand just yet. What I would more often encourage them to do is just take the time to work through this new perspective and to gain an understanding to the best of their ability of how it might feel to walk every single day in the shoes of a minority in America. And so it's not a time, I don't think, for white Americans who are trying to understand to feel ignorant or to feel bad that they don't. I think it's a time for them all to step up and to say, you know what, I haven't had to experience this. And you're not required to apologize for not having to experience it. You shouldn't have to apologize for living the life that you've lived, blessed to whatever degree that you've been blessed. But what I hope is that we all take this time to understand one another better and more deeply.
How do you go about doing that, the understanding? Where do you get that?
So I think first and foremost, one of the things that has created such incredible division in America is that we spend so much time trying to be factually correct instead of right in our person. And what I am encouraging everybody to do is to eliminate the need to be correct and spend more time trying to grow in their ability to empathize with someone and to understand how someone else might feel a particular way across both ways. You know, I would encourage my Black Americans in my community to understand and to work towards, you know, having some empathy towards and understanding how white Americans are experiencing all of this stuff, just like I'm encouraging white Americans to do their best to understand what it has been for the minorities in our country to exist for the last 400 years, right? So both sides.
YMCA members.
Sorry about
Strong
that.
45 will be starting in just a couple minutes in the gym. Strong 45.
It's going to be imperative that we all take the time to work towards growing and understanding one another. And so with that comes, in my opinion, a couple of different responsibilities. A, to sit in a room with people you disagree with. You know, we have this kind of theoretical virus going around now where people think to disagree means you have to dislike one another, or to disagree means you have to be in staunch opposition of someone's person, or it's an indictment against, you know, Paul's character if he sees something differently. That's not the case at all. As a matter of fact, some of my best friends are my best friends because of the fact that they can challenge me in ways, because ideologically they might be different than me and they hold me accountable to the things that I do and the things that I say. So the idea that our differences have to keep us apart is something we've got to get away from. As a matter of fact, it's the diversity of thought. It's the ability to sit in a room full of people different than you, smarter than you, better than you, more experienced than you, richer than you, poorer than you. Like, all of those different things will be necessary for us to move towards a national understanding of what it's like for us to all truly be equal.
And people will talk about healing, I guess. Is that a too lofty of a goal? Do we have to take small steps and just try to keep moving in the right direction? How would you phrase that?
Yeah, it's a relative goal, right? So when you contemplate trauma in any construct, Paul, the healing that is necessary for someone to be healthy is relative, right? So two people going through similar traumas are going to heal and come to that healing in very different ways. And so as a country, our healing is going to, number one, take an incredibly long time. The sins of our past will not be undone by a couple of marches or a couple of protests or an act, or, right, it's going to take time for us to come together. It's going to take what I believe more than likely will be additional angst and additional frustrations on all sides. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take these difficult conversations. It's going to take humility, right? It's going to take people like you and I, who are very different, sitting in a room with one another and saying, you know what, I'm prepared to humble myself in front of you to understand you and to know that that is a two-way street and that you're prepared to do the same thing. And until we get to that point, there's always going to be these ego-driven this ego-driven rhetoric that continues to divide us. And again, you know, the idea that we're all one race is obviously critical to the dialogue. But the idea that you don't see color, I think, is silly, I guess, because we do see color. And it's not that you don't see color, it's that you recognize the differences in that color, and we move forward together anyway. And so there's opportunity in that, and the healing is going to take time, and it's going to take work, lots and lots and lots of work. And so it's going to be hard work. As somebody that spent 2019 seeing a therapist and working on some of the emotional trauma that I've experienced in my life, it's hard work. It's tearful work. It's work that you have to, you know, really get yourself prepared to do. But it's going to be necessary for us as a country if we ever think that we're going to be the great American culture that we claim to be.
So yesterday when we set this up, you called me and I said, Terrell, I want to do this. You and I have known each other for a while. We played basketball together. So we have a relationship. But then I said, well, I'm kind of nervous. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to be a knucklehead. And you said, don't worry about that. You can kind of help. So what is your advice? People want to have this difficult conversation. How do they get started? How do you kind of, you know, get over that initial awkwardness and maybe bridge some gaps?
Just ask. You know, I think number one, ask and be prepared for the consequences, right? There are going to be casualties through this process. There are going to be relationships that suffer. You know, I know for a fact that there are people in our community that have disagreed with the things that I maybe have said via social media or whatever, and that may not care to engage with me, and that's okay. Like, I don't hold that against them. That doesn't bother me. It doesn't frustrate me. But you've got to understand that as you stand up and as you raise your hand and put yourself in front of this inequality, that there are going to be people that disagree with you, and you're going to have to suffer those consequences if you truly want to be a part of the change that is necessary for this country. So start with the conversation. Make yourself uncomfortable and ask somebody who you disagree with, hey, why do you feel this way? How have you gotten to this point? You know, and then sit down and have that open dialogue and that open discussion again with the understanding that you're walking into it with a humble heart and a heart that is prepared for maybe some ugly truths, some truths that you either weren't prepared to understand, some truths that you didn't know existed, right? There's a whole series of experiences that the minorities in this country go through that you just would never have to contemplate if you've never had to contemplate it. And so just being open-minded to it all and not feeling like, you know, you have to be correct, but instead focus on becoming right. And I think that's an important thing to do.
When I talk to people or listen to podcasts or whatever, I often hear it described as if you are a black male, especially of a certain age, every time you may enter a room or a store or whatever, you feel like you are viewed as a potential problem. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, you know, so what I understand about my role here in Wichita, Paul, is that even my experiences as somebody that played here locally and has the relationships I have here in Wichita, the experiences that I have are even muted to the degree that others might be having them in the Houstons and New Yorks and Chicagos and more urban environments or just other environments in general. So to answer your question specifically, it's a partially fair assessment of what it feels like. I know that most times when I enter a room, I'm always aware of my position in that room as a minority. I'm almost always aware as to whether or not there are other minorities in the room. I'm always aware of the fact that people see me differently. You know, I've countless times in my life have seen people physically respond to my entering a room by moving or separating themselves from me, or, you know, walking through a parking lot and seeing, you know, a Caucasian female see me and lock her door, right? Like, those are the kinds of little small things that you just blow by, but they're a part of the experience of, you know, a black male in America anymore. And so we are very aware of those things. I don't know that there's a black male in America that would tell you that when he walks into a room, he doesn't know immediately whether or not there are other minorities in that room, right? So it's a real assessment.
I had that. I think my one and only experience with this is 2005. I would have gone down to Houston to do a story about P.J. Kuznard mm-hmm. when I worked at the Wichita Eagle. And I got down there on Friday night, and his family took me to the Bennigan's in, I assume it was the 3rd Ward District. And we walked into Bennigan's, and it was packed, and I believe I was the only white person in there. And it was quite, never forgotten what that was like to experience that. Okay, over these last few weeks, as this all kind of unfolded, we've seen a lot of coaches, a lot of schools, teams, leaders, you know, they're speaking out in many different ways. They're, you know, issuing statements, videos, they're having town halls. I know Wichita State has had a couple of, sessions about racial events. You can join on Zoom. Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, they speak out quite enthusiastically on this. Lavelle Moten, the basketball coach at North Carolina Central, has been really outspoken and called on more prominent coaches to really speak out. So that's my long-winded way of getting to, why do these voices matter? How can they help?
You know, they matter for weird reasons, but that's probably a different topic. it's important that they speak up because they're voices that are heard. They're voices that, because of the way that we are constructed societally, they're voices that weigh more, right? They're voices that, especially, you know, the Steve Kerrs and the Greg Popoviches of the world, right? The ones who are white Americans, who coach in a sport dominated by Black Americans, who recognize these injustices and this inequality and are raising their hand and standing up for it and speaking on it. That is critical because I think that lends a little bit of credence and a little bit of support, not a little bit, a lot of support towards the movement itself and towards the efforts of minorities here in America to receive just the same level of equality that I think we all deserve. And so it's important that those voices step up because, you know, in America, we value athletics. Different topic, but far more than we should. And this is coming from a former athlete. And so voices in athletics, I think, are going to be paramount, just like they have been throughout, you know, throughout time. You think of the Muhammad Ali's of the world, right? You think of the Jackie Robinsons, who, while he was not particularly outspoken, still stood when the time came to stand. Those voices are necessary to ensure that our country looks at it and sees it and understands that it is a real problem that affects everything and it affects us all.
I'm gonna let you get back to work. I'll give you a chance to maybe sum it up, give us a last piece of advice before we go.
Yeah, love. I'm a lover. I tell people all the time how much I love them, and I think this process is going to have to begin with love. And love is a difficult thing, Paul, right? Love is not always roses and flowers, and like love sometimes is sitting in front of somebody and loving them enough to accept their reality and accept their truths, whether they are yours or not. And so I just want to implore everybody to love one another, to love our country and to love our people in a way that enables their hearts to be open to their experiences and to be open to the dialogue necessary for us to move this country forward. It's only going to be through that, right? You know, I'm seeing a lot of people referencing Martin Luther King, and as well we should during this time, right? And he spoke about love, and he spoke about light, and how we've got to shed light on the darkness that runs rampant in our community. And so, have these conversations, love each other, and take the time to love each other truly and completely, authentically and sincerely. It's gonna be hard, it's gonna be difficult, it's gonna be painful, but we have to be willing to do that for one another. You know, these riots and these protests and the destruction and the looting, it's not right. But take a minute to understand how the trauma that this community has experienced over all these years might move them to something like that. And instead of condemning that, instead of moving your focus towards that, keep the focus on the issue that has caused it, right? The people that are doing this looting and doing the rioting and doing these different things, they will suffer the consequences for those things, as should the people that continue to impose and oppress minorities in America should also suffer the necessary consequences for those actions. But when it's all said and done, if we're not speaking out of love, if we're not moving and acting out of love, if we're not standing up for one another in love, then it's going to be real difficult for us to see this as lasting change, society, like generational change. And that's what I would encourage everybody to do.